So what we're going to do is, I think what we're going to do is just look at the poems that I distributed today, and I will, Freya asked when the final paper was due. So according to the syllabus, it's due a week from Thursday. Is that right? I think that's right. But you can have, or maybe it's a week from today. Anyhow, you can have till December 9th, plus the standard. Yes, I've almost got it done, and I'm going to get it in soon, extra week. You don't have to ask, so you can get a free extension if you need it through the 16th. I think everyone here has gotten both papers in, but maybe unsurprisingly, it's not true of everyone in the class. Yeah, go ahead.
On the syllabus, it said rewrite. We got to rewrite it?
No, it doesn't say rewrite.
You
know? No. Yeah, it's about poetry. Sorry.
Oh.
It's what we were doing in the last class, the way Dickinson... Sorry, that was very misleading. It's not about your writing. It's about the writing of the people where they were reading. So the on the syllabus, or what we did in the last class, which was to look at how Dickinson revises Keats. So just to remind you, and that's basically what we're going to be doing. I hope also looking at a couple more forms, one of which is on the handout that I gave you today. But the way Dickinson revises Keats, just to summarize very quickly what we were talking about last, or it was more than a week ago, because last Tuesday was canceled, so 10 days ago, is that Keats has this urn say what? What does the urn say? Famous lines? Yeah, other way around. Beauty is truth, truth, beauty. I restrained myself from telling you this then, but I'll tell you now that just to see how ways that people think about poetry changes, there was a Freudian reading of that poem which understood what Keats was actually saying to be, you ready for it? Body is turd. Turd body. So the human body is shit, and shit is the human body. So I don't think that that's an accurate reading of the poem, but it was what's called a vulgar Freudian reading of about 70 years ago. But beauty is truth, truth, beauty. That is all you know on earth and all you need to know. And Dickinson doesn't agree. So Keats is laid in the adjoining tomb, remember? I died for beauty, but was scarce adjusted in the tomb when one who died for truth was laid in an adjoining room. He asked me why I failed. For beauty, I replied, and I for truth, themself are one. That is, they're both the same thing. We brethren are, he said. And he thinks that truth is eternal. That is, that what Dickinson is seeing in the Ode on a Grecian Urn is that when the urn will last to later ages and keep saying to other generations, beauty is truth, truth, beauty, the urn is asserting what it thinks to be a truth. That is, it would be true, according to Keats, that beauty is truth and truth beauty. And that would make truth more important than beauty. That is, that truth is the thing that you can rely on the urn to give you, and the truth that it gives you is the truth is also beauty, and that beauty is also truth. But Dickinson is saying, no, things don't last. The moss will cover up our names. Things don't last. And so what Keats in the adjoining room is saying, that beauty and truth are the same thing, Dickinson says, we talked and the moss covered up our names. Things don't last. So that's a revision. That is Dickinson reading Keats's poem and essentially saying, no, he got it wrong. Or not even that he got it wrong, because that would be asserting a truth as well. But Dickinson simply let dying for beauty and being indifferent to the fact that the moss covered up their names, that the beauty is just the beauty, and you don't need the guarantee or the prestige of truth that Keats seemed to think you did need. So that's a very quick summary of what we were discussing 10 days ago. But I think that it's a good example of how poems revise each other and revise earlier poems. So what you have here is a whole bunch of poems. We're not going to get to them all. The ones we don't get to will be the ones that you can write your third paper on. So we will discuss. But I also want to use this a little bit to point out a particular form of poetry. So we haven't gone through all the forms that we might have. But one form is a form called a ghazal. Do people know what that is? Does anyone know what it is? So it's a Persian form. And it came into European poetry, I think, with Goethe, although I'm not sure about that. But Goethe has a very important book called The East-West Divan at the end of the 18th century. And then in the 19th century, do people know who Alfred Lord Tennyson is? Who is he?
Oh, he is.
Yeah, okay. So he is probably most famous for... Yes, good. Can you recite it?
Yes.
Go for it. Go for it.
He clasps the crowd with crooked hands, close to the sun and lowly in foamy bands. Something with the azure world he stands. Standing at his mountain walls. I'm missing a line.
Yeah, but just do the last line. Yes, and like a thunderbolt, he falls. All right. You all know at least one, two famous phrases from Tennyson, which I'll get to in a second. But you also may know the really crappy poem, in my very, very humble opinion, that we had to memorize. Partly we're going to be talking a little bit about that we had to memorize in elementary school. Which is, so tell me if this is familiar. Flower in the crannied wall. No, I pluck you out of the crannies as I stand here with you in my hand. I'm holding you root and all. I know that if I understood you root and all in all, I should understand what God and man is. So I'm just remembering that actually from elementary school. And it was actually a poem that the Zen master, T.D. Suzuki, thought was just terrible. Why'd he pluck the flower out of the wall? What the hell is wrong with him? But that used to be a very famous staple of learning poetry when you were in elementary school in the U.S., Flower in the Crannied Wall. Ask your grandparents. They'll know it. They'll bore you with it. But what you do know by him is the phrase, nature red in tooth and claw. So that's sort of a cliche, but that's actually Tennyson. Nature red in tooth and claw. And a line that he came up with in a poem that was to some extent a response to Darwinian thinking in the 1850s. And the same poem, it's a poem, an elegy for, people know what an elegy is? What's an elegy? A poem which is an elegy? So an elegy is a poem of mourning when someone dies. Mm-hmm. Yes. I could tell. So an elegy is a poem of mourning. And he wrote an elegy for a friend of his who dropped dead at the age of 23. Hope this isn't too close to home, of a cerebral hemorrhage. And Tennyson was in love with this man and wrote a very, very long elegy for him. And the most famous line in the elegy, besides "Nature, red in tooth and claw," probably even more famous, is, "'Tis better to have and
lost
than
never have loved at all."
Yes, so that's Tennyson. "'Tis better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all." So that's what he's thinking about this guy whose name is Arthur Henry Hallam. That better to have known him, to have loved and lost him, than never to have loved at all. Okay, so Tennyson was one of the people to bring into English poetry this form called a ghazal. And so if you take a look on the sheet in front of you, you'll see on the first page, the third column, Tennyson, A Song from the Princess. So The Princess is a long narrative poem. And in that poem, songs get sung in various interesting forms. Does someone want to read it? This is, again, very famous. Alanish.
Now sleeps a crimson petal, not the white, nor waves the cypress in the palace wall. Nor wings the
book bend in the porphyry font. Yep.
The firefly wakened with me. Now droops the milk-white peacock like a ghost, and like a ghost he glims unto me. Now lies the earth all the name to the stars, and all thy heart lies upon unto me. Now slides the meteor on, leaves the shining furrow as thy thoughts in me. Now flows the lily all her sweetness up and slips into the bosom of the lake. So fold thyself, my dearest, though, and slip into my bosom, and be lost in me.
Thank you. Yeah, so is this familiar to anyone? The most famous line is, now sleeps the crimson petal, now the white. Okay, so it's darkness, it's nighttime, and just to go through it quickly, we won't spend time on it, but to go through it quickly, it's very evocative, very visual, but also very evocative of the end of visuality, or at least nighttime flowers rather than the brightness of day. So now sleeps the crimson petal, now the white. That is the red and the white petals. The flowers have closed. Nor waves the cypress in the palace walk, which is poetic, for the cypress is now waving in the palace walk now because it's calm. So, nor winks the gold fin in the porphyry font. So porphyry is a kind of marble-like material. A porphyry font would be a fountain, and the goldfish that live in the waters in the fountain, they're asleep too. So all of these things are asleep. Now sleeps the crimson petal, now the white, nor waves the cypress in the palace walk, nor winks the gold fin in the porphyry font. But something does waken. The firefly wakens. Waken thou with me. So here we are. It's nighttime. It's a beautiful night. The fireflies are out. Waken thou with me. And notice the me at the end of the stanza. Now droops the milk-white peacock like a ghost. And like a ghost, she glimmers on to me. So the peacock is glimmering onto the speaker like a ghost. Now lies the earth all denay to the stars. That is, the earth has opened starlight, the way Danae was open to Zeus in the myth. And all thy heart lies open unto me. Now slides the silent meteor on and leaves a shining furrow as thy thoughts in me. So he sees a meteor in the dark, leaving a silent furrow as his thoughts of her leave a furrow within him. Now folds the lily all her sweetness up. So now it's another flower that's closing. Now folds the lily all her sweetness up and slips into the bosom of the lake. So fold thyself, my dearest thou, and slip into my bosom and be lost in me. So you can notice that every stanza begins with the word now, and every stanza ends with the word me. And ghazals are generally two-line stanzas. So Tennyson is experimenting with the form, but they're generally two-line stanzas, whose second line always ends the same way. Sometimes the second line is exactly the same each time. So you can see how they're kind of related to a villanelle. Remember, how does a villanelle work, anyone?
One, two, and the next one ends with one, and the next one ends with two, and then they complete by being back to.
Right. Yeah, so the first line one, a middle line, and line two, and line three. And then the next stanza ends with a repetition of line one. The stanza after that ends with a repetition of line three, and they alternate. So what you're having is a repetition of lines. Sometimes a repetition simply of end words, but it's repetition rather than rhyme. Villanelles do both, because the two lines that get repeated rhyme with each other, but the end words are repeated rather than rhyming. And it's really important, let me just stress again, that rhyme and repetition are different things. Rhyme is precisely not repetition. Repetition is precisely not rhyme. Rhyme is always a different word, so that it is putting into juxtaposition things that are similar on one dimension but different on another dimension. But in something like a ghazal, in something like a villanelle, and something like a sestina, you get a repetition of the same word. And the difference then is going to be in how you get to that word. And in a way, it's all these amazing different ways that you can get to the same word, to the repetition. So take a look at the poem at the bottom of that column called Even the Rain by Agha Shahid Ali. He was an Iranian-American poet, and he has a whole book of ghazals. This is one of them. Does anyone know the line, "Nobody, not even the rain, has such small hands"? Not a familiar line to anyone? Okay, it's a famous line from E. Cummings about the coming of spring. So the phrase, "even the rain," is actually a quotation. In the same way that I died for beauty but was scarce, adjusted in the tomb when one who died for truth was laid in an adjoining room. That's not a quotation, but it's a very strong reminder of the quotation. So here is the actual quotation. Here's the ghazal by Ali. And I just want to show it to you quickly before we get into what we'll be concentrating on today. But before that, look at the Adrian Rich poem, between the two poems. Someone want to read it? It's a poem called Poetry, but she wrote several more poems called Poetry, so this is the first. Asma.
Someone at a table under a brown metal lamp is studying the history of poetry. Someone in the library at closing time has learned to say modernism, trope, Vatic, text. She is listening for shreds of music. He is searching for his name back in the old country. They cannot learn without teachers. They are like us, what we were, if you remember. In a corner of night, a voice is crying a kind of whisper, more. K. Can you remember when we thought the poets taught how to live? That is not the voice of a critic or a common reader. It is someone young, in anger, hardly knowing what to ask, who finds our lines, our glosses, wanting in this world.
Thank you. So, do people know who Adrienne Rich was? Is this a familiar name?
She has that poem that starts with, like, you want to know if I'm lonely, and yes, I'm lonely. That's the only thing I know.
Okay, so she was a major, major feminist poet of, I'd say the 60s through the 90s, maybe. Radical feminist, openly lesbian when people weren't, and very political, especially in her later poems. Here in this poem, you can feel some of the attitude that could manifest itself as political poetry, although this is not a political poem. But just to go through it again quickly. There's a library and students or people studying at the library anyhow. And one of them is studying the history of poetry. And what words is she learning? Letter?
Modernism, Vatic text.
Yeah. Most of the words that you learn in various English classes, except probably Vatic. Have you learned Vatic? Mm-hmm. Anyone know what Vatic means? Having a kind of prophetic openness to inspiration, let's say. Vatic poetry is poetry that sounds like it's coming from some otherworldly, semi-theological place, so it sounds prophetic. So at the time that she's writing this, these are the kinds of words that you will find in classrooms teaching courses like this. I don't know if we've used the word trope, but everyone knows what a trope is. You know it from TV tropes, right? Trope means, it literally means a turning, but it tends to mean a figure of speech or a recognizable structure in a discursive work, whether it's a poem, a novel, a story, a TV show, or a speech. So you could, for example, talk about anti-Semitic tropes in Ye's tweets. And a lot of people would know what you were talking about. A lot of people would, but a lot of people would. So someone is studying the history of poetry. Great. And they've learned to say modernism, trope, Vatic, text. So I'll just say right now, if you manage to get all four of these words into your next paper, I'll give you a tiny bit of extra credit. But tell no one who's not here today. Okay, so, but, and there's an implied but here. She is listening for shreds of music. So she doesn't want just modernism, trope, Vatic text. Oh, the trope of the Vatic text is a feature of modernism. That's the kind of thing you might hear in an English class. The trope of the Vatic text is a feature of modernism. Or modernism treats the Vatic text merely as another trope. So how's that for insight? Is it like, wow, we're not worthy? That insight is so great? No? Darn. Okay, so, but she is listening for shreds of music. He, the other person in the library, is searching for his name back in the old country. So he's looking at genealogy. They cannot learn without teachers. And maybe that's a good thing, that learning may not be the best thing here. They cannot learn without teachers. They are like us, what we were, if you remember. So we once had this ambivalent relationship to being taught the theory of poetry, to being taught the important aspects of poetry, like text and modernism and Vatic and trope. Good. So they cannot learn without teachers. They are like us. What we were, if you remember, in a corner of night, a voice is crying in a kind of whisper, more. More than what? What is that voice crying in the corner of night? Why does she hear it? So more means something isn't enough. Mm-hmm. What isn't enough?
Cut and dry literary analysis.
Yeah, okay, good. So does that voice want more cut and dry literary analysis? Yes, trope, Vatic, text, so great, modernism. I love it, I eat it up, give me more. How about transcendental signifier? Would that be good? Is that what the voice wants?
No.
No.
Or that they like find out there's more and they just start crying.
Yeah. No, but I think what this voice wants is stop reducing poetry to this technical crap. More is what that voice wants. It wants poetry. It doesn't want Vatic and text and trope and modernism. So that's, they are like us, what we were. If you remember, in a corner of night, beautiful phrase, a corner of night, a voice is crying in a kind of whisper, more. Can you remember when we thought the poets taught how to live? That is not the voice of a critic or a common reader either. The voice of a critic, that is someone who thinks that learning the theory and vocabulary of poetry really matters, or a common reader, that is someone who says, yeah, I like reading poetry before I go to bed. I like reading poetry on the pot when I get up in the morning before I go about my day. No, this voice that wants more is something else. Not a critic, not a common reader either. It is someone young, in anger, hardly knowing what to ask, finds our lines, our glosses, wanting in this world. So that's who really wants poetry. Someone young, not like her anymore. She remembers it. But this is also unutterably sad, that it's somehow the loss of an attitude towards poetry. So I think it's a great poem. It is someone young in anger, hardly knowing what to ask, just asking for more, but hardly knowing what to ask, who finds our lines, our glosses. What's a gloss? What does that word mean there? Yeah, it means an explanation. So glossary is a kind of gloss, but a gloss basically means what this means here is. So if you gloss something, those are like footnotes in the Norton Anthology, which I know you don't know about because you didn't buy it. But they're like the footnotes that explain the hard moments. But this person finds her lines, our glosses, wanting in this world. That is not giving what's necessary, what's needed, as in I find you wanting. Okay, so here's Shahid Ali's ghazal. What will suffice for a true love not? Even the rain? But he has bought grief's lottery, bought even the rain. our glosses, wanting in this world. Can you remember anyone when we thought the poets taught even the rain? So what's he doing there? Don't turn over yet. Yeah, how? Where's the, what parts are from Rich?
Our glosses are in this world and we thought the poets.
Yeah, what about can you remember? So two things are in quotation marks and come out of Rich's poem. And one line is not in quotation marks and also comes out of Rich's poem. So can, she has can, new line, you remember. He has that on the same line. Can you remember? She has, who finds our lines, our glosses, wanting in this world, in her last line. And also, when we thought the poets taught, even when we thought the poets taught. How has he done something tricky or slightly unexpected with those quotations? So just to go back to an earlier thing when we were talking about text and how modernism changes the tropes of the Vedic origin of poetry, remember that we said what defines a poem ultimately is the line, that the most important and central formal quality of a poem is the line, which is to say the line up to its ending. And that's why when you quote poetry, you have to respect line endings. That's why some of you, if you quote some poems in your prose, quotation marks are not enough. You need slashes for the line endings. So it's Mary had a little lamb slash. Little lamb slash. Mary had a little lamb slash. Its fleece was white as snow. So I know a lot of you didn't think of Mary had a little lamb as slash fiction, but it is. So line endings matter. How is she using the slashes? How is he using the slashes?
He's not using them correctly because our glosses wanting in this world is just one line of her poem. The slash isn't needed in that one, and then the slash is in the wrong place. And when we thought the poets taught, it should be after the word poets.
Yeah, when we thought the poets taught how to live. So ask yourself why, but one thing to notice, we won't pause on this, but one thing to notice is that what he does, if you'd only had his poem and didn't know that this poem was troping on an earlier poem by Adrian Rich, that paragon of modernism, whose Vedic texts are so important, you would know he was quoting a poem, right? You would know it from the slashes. And so when you see when we thought the poets taught, what would you imagine the poem he's quoting from? What would you imagine about the poem he's quoting from? That it rhymes, yeah. When we thought the poets taught, our lives were fraught with what we sought. Yeah, so he takes something that no one reading the Rich poem would notice the rhyme there, right? Did anyone notice it? Thought and taught? So you remember, can you remember when we thought the poets taught how to live? Partly it's a question of how line endings distribute stress or distribute meter, when we thought the poets taught how to live. But if it's when we thought the poets taught, you're going to notice the rhyme. So he noticed it. Our glosses wanting in this world, there you're not getting a rhyme, but you're definitely getting a quotation from a poem. And yet, a last line, who find our lines, our glosses wanting in this world, becomes our glosses wanting in this world. Putting the slashes in really gives meter to something, a much stronger beat to something that Rich didn't seem to want that strong beat in. You're listening for it. It's shreds of music. But what he's doing with it, maybe he's heard it. Maybe that shred of music has become more powerful for him. But anyhow, there's a revision. There is a poem quoting another poem, but quoting it while messing with the line endings. And the messing with the line endings makes a difference. Do you all agree? Do you hear the difference there? But what he's doing is he's writing a ghazal. So what will suffice for a true love knot? Even the rain? A true love knot. What's a true love knot? Anyone know? So a modern version might be a lanyard. Did you ever do that in camp? Take gum wrappers and fold them up into lanyards? So now this is... I beg your pardon, I spent my youth doing this, and you scorn.
What, like rappers? Like gum wrappers?
Yeah.
They have like actual lanyards.
I know they have like actual, thank you. When I was young, we couldn't afford actual lanyards in summer camp. We had to buy Wrigley Spearmint gum.
But why?
I'll tell you why. Because what you would do is you would take the wrapper and you would fold it really tight and split it in half, and then you would fold the two halves and link them together, and then you would do it with another wrapper and another wrapper and another wrapper, and eventually, if you got a lanyard made of gum wrappers, you wanted them to be twice as long as the person you were in love with, and when it was twice as long as the person you were in love with, you would burn it and put it in a box under your pillow, and then you would dream of them and maybe something good would happen.
Wow.
So what do you guys, I mean, once iPads come in, it's like all these really interesting things you could do with your time. You're just not doing them anymore. It's terrible. Okay, anyhow. What is happening here is that he keeps going back to even the rain, and a true love knot is something that would be a symbol of how you were tied together. It would be like a heart-shaped knot that would symbolize how you were tied together with the person whom you were in love with. Coleridge has a poem about John Donne. We haven't done John Donne, except those of you who wrote on The Flea, and you all studied The Flea. Samuel Taylor Coleridge, remember Rime of the Ancient Mariner, hated Donne. And he talked about Donne as one who's, he says, with Donne, whose muse on dromedary trots, that is, Donne's muse is trotting on a camel, with Donne, whose muse on dromedary trots, wreathe iron pokers into true love knots. So that's what he thought Donne's poetry was about. You're making a true love knot out of an iron poker for a fire. And it was just ridiculous, Coleridge thought. But here's a true love knot. What will suffice for a true love knot? What's enough for true love? Even the rain? But he has bought grief's lottery, bought even the rain. So if you think rain will somehow symbolize true love, well, no, that's grief's lottery. Great phrase. He's bought even the rain. Our gloss is wanting in this world. Can you remember? So what is it that he is asking the addressee to remember? Because now that's the line is from Rich, but it's not in quotation marks. Well, if you didn't know the Rich poem, our glosses wanting in this world, can you remember? What are you being asked to remember? What is the addressee of this poem being asked to remember?
The other poem?
Yes! That line, do you remember it? Our glosses wanting in this world. Can you remember? So, something that transcends this world, the love, even if it's grief's lottery, even if it won't last. Yeah.
It's also sort of reflexive because you have to remember that line. The line itself of can you remember, you must recall from the original poem, but it's not in quotation marks. So to really recognize it, you don't have sort of contextual clues, you need to really recall it.
Right. So it's like recalling, it's almost as though it's recalling a poem. He's asking the addressee, do you remember this poem? And he doesn't even realize that very line comes from the poem that he nevertheless has a dim memory of with the addressee. Can you remember? But yeah, it's coming from that poem too. The speaker, Shahid Ali obviously knows what he's doing, but the speaker doesn't. Anyone, when we thought the poets taught even the rain, because the rain might be a true love nod. So what you'll notice now in the rest of the ghazal is that every line and every second line ends, every stanza ends with the phrase, even the rain. So that's the ghazal. After we died, that was it. God left us in the dark. And as we forgot the dark, we forgot even the rain. Drought was over because it was raining. Where was I? Drinks were on the house. For mixers, my love, you'd poured what? Even the rain. Of this pear-shaped orange's perfume twist, I will say, extract vermouth from the bergamot, even the rain. How did the enemy love you with earth, air, and fire? He held just one thing back till he got even the rain. So what's going on in that stanza? Yeah, it's the same three words. Even the rain, but it's not he got even the rain, it's he got even the rain. So he held one thing back till he got even. What did he hold back? The rain. This is God's site for a new house of executions. You swear by the Bible, despot, even the rain. So you're swearing by the rain too. Remember Noah? After the bones, those flowers. This was found in the urn, the lost river, ashes from the ghat, even the rain. What was I to prophesy, if not the end of the world? A salt pillar for the lonely lot, even the rain. What's the little joke there, biblical joke?
Lot's wife.
Right, who turns into?
Pillar of salt.
Okay. How the air raged desperate, streaming the earth with flames to help burn down my house. Fire sought even the rain. So fire wanted, destruction was so intent on me that fire would even seek rain to help burn down my house. He, fire, would raise the mountains. He would level the waves. He would, to smooth his epic plot, even the rain. So what's the word even doing there? Yes, it's a verb, even out the rain, to smooth his epic plot. New York belongs at daybreak to only me, just me, to make this claim memories brought even the rain. So it's a perfect morning for New York to be just me. Memory, my memory of it has brought even the rain to this early morning. They found the knife that killed you, but whose prints are these? No one has such small hands, Shahid. Not even the rain. So that's the quote from Cunningham, from Cummings. No one, not even the rain, has such small hands. Okay, so I wanted to show you that form, the ghazal, which is a great form, and also to show you the way poems are rewriting each other. In particular, Rich is writing about trying to remember poems and poetry when it meant something and wasn't just an object of study in English 10b. And here is Shahid Ali remembering the Rich poem and also remembering the form of the ghazal, which, as I say, he wrote more ghazals probably than any contemporary English language poet of the last 30 or 40 years. He has a whole book of ghazals. All right, let's look at another series of poems. So look at the poem right after that one, the poem called Casabianca by Felicia Hemans. So Felicia Hemans was an early 19th century poet, most famous really for this poem, but there are some other poems by her that you will know. Looking her up, Alanish?
No.
Oh, okay. And this is a poem, just so you know, that back in the 40s, maybe from the 20s to the 50s, I don't even know when, but back a ways, this was maybe even late 19th century, this was a standard poem that you had to memorize in junior high school, as it was then called. It's now called middle school. It's not quite the same thing. And so everyone memorized this poem. And the poem is about a boy whose name is Casabianca. So don't say, oh, Casabianca, that means White House. Is this about January 6th? No. It happened to be that his last name was Casabianca. And in 1898, in a naval encounter between France and England, his father was the captain of an English ship, and his son was one of the people on the ship, and his father said, stay on the deck to fight the enemy and to prevent them from boarding until I give you the order to leave, but do not leave without my order. I think he was a 9-year-old boy, because when you were 9 at the time, yeah, you fought in sea battles. And then, after giving this order, his father was mortally wounded by ordnance from the French side. And he went below deck to try to recover, and he died. So the boy never got the order to abandon ship, even as the ship was burning up. And so he died because he followed his father's order. So it's a real tearjerker of a situation, a tearjerker of a poem. And Hemans, 28 years later, writes a poem about this famous event called Casabianca. Someone want to read it? Or do I pick you at random? Jesse, I picked you once before, right? Mm-hmm. So I won't pick you at random. Okay, yeah, go.
Loves the boy so.
No. Right after Not Even the Rain. There are two poems called Casabianca. It's the 1826 one we want.
I don't want to read that one.
Okay, then let's see. Lillian. Sorry, Lily. I was confusing you with Jillian for a second.
The boy stood on the burning deck, whence all but he had fled, the flame that lit the battle's wreck, shone round o'er the dead. Yet beautiful and bright he stood, as born to rule the storm, a creature of heroic blood, a proud though childlike form. The flames, oh, it's all the way up there. Okay, the flames, he would not go without his father's word. That father faint in death below, his voice no longer heard. He called aloud, "Say, father, say, if yet my task is done." He knew not that Chieftain lay unconscious of his son.
Chieftain.
Chieftain. "Speak, father," once again he cried, "if I may yet be gone." And but the booming shouts replied, and fast the flames rolled on. Upon his blow he felt their breath, in his waving hair, and looked from the womb, host of death, and still yet brave despair. And shouted but once more aloud, "My father, must I stay?" When o'er him fast, through sail and shroud, the wreathing fires made way. The wrap, the ship, and his splendor wild, they caught the flag on high and streamed above the gallant child, like banners in the sky. There came to burst of thunder sound, the boy, oh, where was he? Ask of the winds that far around with fragments strewed the sea. With mast and helm and pennon fair, that well had borne their part, but the noblest thing which perished there was the young faithful heart.
Thank you. Anyone recognize the form of the poem? It is an ancient mariner, and he stoppeth one of three by the long group.
It's ABAB.
Okay, it's ABAB is the rhyme scheme. Notice it's longer line, shorter line. Longer line, shorter line. 4 feet, 3 feet, 4 feet, 3 feet. What is it? It is. It is. It's always great when people say it's not, because that almost always means they're getting it right. Yeah, it's ballad meter, sometimes called common meter. So she's writing a ballad about this boy. And, you know, it can be, you can read it, you can be moved by it. It's sentimental, obviously, but sentimentality's okay. So there's this boy. The boy stood, we'll do it again. We always try to do poems twice. The boy stood on the burning deck whence all but he had fled. So everyone else has, the deck is burning. The boy stood there. Everyone else has abandoned ship, but he's still there. The flame that lit the battle's wreck shone round him o'er the dead. So ships are burning, dead people everywhere. He's lit up by the flame of the burning ships that lit the battle's wreck. Yet beautiful and bright he stood, as born to rule the storm. So you can imagine a crappy 19th century painting of this boy. I bet there are some. In which it looks like he's an elemental god. He's just standing there, this young boy, flames around him, and he's just standing there without fear. Yet beautiful and bright he stood, as born to rule the storm, a creature of heroic blood, a proud, though childlike, form. The flames rolled on. He would not go without his father's word, because his father told him not to go. So unless his father gave him the word, he was going to stay on that deck. That father, faint in death below, his voice no longer heard. So he's calling to his father in the next stanza, but his father can't hear his voice. He called aloud, "Say, father, say, if yet my task is done, can I leave this burning deck now?" But he knew not that the chieftain lay unconscious of his son. "Speak, father," once again he cried, "if I may yet be gone." And, but the booming shots replied, and fast the flames rolled on. So what happens with the end? He's cut off by the shots, yeah. "Speak, father," once again he cried, "if I may yet be gone." And, but the booming shots replied, and fast the flames rolled on. Upon his brow he felt their breath, and in his waving hair, and looked from that lone post of death in still yet brave despair, and shouted but once more, only once more does he shout, and shouted but once more aloud, "My father, must I stay?" While o'er him fast, through sail and shroud, the wreathing fires made way. So the artillery is shooting over him, flaming as it passes over him, setting everything aflame. Those fires, the wreathing fires, they wrapped the ship in splendor wild. They caught the flag on high and streamed above the gallant child like banners in the sky. There came a burst of thunder sound. The boy, oh, where was he? Ask of the winds that far around with fragments strewed the sea. So where was the boy?
In the ocean with all the wreckage.
Yeah, yeah, gone. Next time you look at him, he's gone. With mast and helm and pennon fair, so with parts of the ship, pennon is the sails or the flags, with mast and helm and pennon fair, that well had borne their part. So they're destroyed, but they did what they had to do before they were destroyed. That well had borne their part. But the noblest thing which perished there was that young, faithful heart. So, who's dead?
The boy.
The boy, good, yes. So, do you all have hearts of stone? You're not weeping?
I'm a bit sad right now, yeah.
Okay. Well, just remember, he'd be dead anyhow by now. So it's okay. He'd be dead for, you know, like 200 years by now. He was probably born the same year that Byron was born.
He was alive a minute ago.
Well, that's a good point, too. Okay, anyhow, famous, famous schoolroom poem that everyone had to memorize in the U.S. and I think in England, but I'm not sure. But that everyone had to memorize in the U.S. It was just part of the curriculum. But then Ron DeSantis came and... All right. That was a joke, too. So then Elizabeth Bishop in 1965 writes a poem called Casabianca. So we've already done a few Elizabeth Bishop poems, so you have a sense of who she is. Or maybe you don't, but more sense than if we hadn't done any. What was her villanelle?
One art.
Yeah, remember? The art of losing isn't hard to master. Some things seem so filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. And then she lists all the things she's lost. Her keys, where it was she meant to travel, and then houses and continents. But it's evident that the art of losing is not too hard to master. Even losing you, a face, a gesture I love, it's evident the art of losing is not too hard to master, although sometimes it feels like, remember how it ends? Write it like disaster. Okay, so that's the famous Bishop villanelle, One Art. So this is an earlier poem of hers called what, Elijah?
Casabianca.
Oh, would you like to read it?
Sure.
Great.
Love is the boy stood on the burning deck, trying to recite. The boy stood on the burning deck. Love's the sun stood stammering locution while the poor ship in flames went down. Love's the obstinate boy, the ship, even the swimming sailors who would like the classroom platform too, or an excuse to stay on deck. And love's the burning boy.
Great, thank you. So, this is a great revision of Heman's. And what's the first thing that you would want to say about it? It's puzzling. It's not like, oh, okay, I'm just going to explain this. I died for beauty, so that's all fine. But in a way, a little bit it is. Only a little, but not zero. All right, so what do you make of this poem? Is an example of modernism? Is this a Vedic text? What are the tropes? Just any part of the poem that strikes you first looking at it. Vlanish.
I don't know if I'm interpreting correct, but I feel like this poet is personifying love in order to like demonstrate like the ups and downs of it.
Okay.
Is that like that?
Yeah, same word. What are the ups, what are the downs?
I think the use of burning and like poor ship in flames went down. I think it's like kind of describing love as like a roller coaster.
Yeah.
And like all you have to go through to achieve it.
Mm-hmm.
Or like the possible effects of it.
Okay, I like the fact that you're using one metaphor, the roller coaster, to describe a different vehicle, which is the ship. Okay, so it's like what happens to the it's like you're using the roller coaster to describe what's happening to the ship. Do you know what it means for marriage to be on the rocks? Have you ever heard that?
Y'all struggling?
Yeah. Do you know where that comes from? That's a metaphor too.
On the rocks?
Yeah.
I hear that when you order alcohol.
Yeah, but that's not what it means when a marriage is on the rocks. Oh yeah, I'll have a marriage on the rocks. Oh, I'll have mine straight up. Yeah, if they founder on the rocks, that's where that phrase comes from. And when you actually have a drink with ice, it's kind of like, okay, it's like when a ship is on the rocks, we'll just have some alcohol on the rocks. Or it's like water and rocks at like a main seashore where there are lots of rocks in the ocean. It means, so do you know what elocution is?
No.
Elocution is speaking well, speaking eloquently. If you take oral literacy classes, you will, that's essentially a version of learning elocution. So you have to do oral literacy in anything you major in, right? So locution just means, it's essentially the same thing, speaking articulately and well. And one reason that people were taught to memorize poetry and to recite it in the last century was the idea is that if you could recite a poem well, this would be a good way to learn to speak well, to speak convincingly, to produce powerful phraseology. Yes. Yes, exactly. So, yeah, where do you see that precisely?
I mean, like the first couple lines, like kind of the whole thing, like, you know, the boy is standing on the burning deck trying to recite the poem. Like, it's getting, like, introspective about it. And then the locution, too, stammering locution, like, can't do it, and talking about schoolroom platform, and it's just all kind of poking fun.
Yeah. Okay, so the boy in this poem is trying to recite what?
The other poem.
Yeah. So this is a poem about, first of all, someone trying to recite that other poem. Yeah.
It's about someone being forced to recite the other poem in a classroom, perhaps. Like being cold called.
So to speak, yes. Good. Massimo.
Like the boy in the story was sort of forced to stay on the ship, even though he probably really didn't want to end there. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so here is someone or something standing on the burning deck trying to recite a description a poem that seems metaphorically relevant, the way the roller coaster that Iwanish mentioned would be metaphorically relevant. So, loves the boy. Do you understand the grammar of that, by the way? Loves the boy stood on the burning deck?
Like love is.
Yeah, so love is the boy. Then you might want to add another word. Who? Yeah, so it's a little bit of an Irish locution when you'd leave out a who or a that. So loves the boy who stood on the burning deck, trying to recite the poem by Felicia Hemans, whose first line is. Okay, so what's happening with, what's similar to what Shahid Ali is doing to Rich?
Quoting it.
Quoting it.
And separating the line.
And yeah, but not respecting the line endings. Mm-hmm. Giving you a different line ending. So. Wait, let's say it louder, I'm sorry. Yes. No, she absolutely does. The boy stood on the burning deck, loves the sun. Yeah. So she's not rhyming what Hemans rhymes, but she's definitely rhyming. Look at who and to. And if you look at who and to, you'll start noticing locution and down, and then stay and boy. So deck doesn't rhyme with anything, and ship doesn't rhyme with anything, but it's mainly a subtly rhymed poem. We talked a little bit about this when we talked about Mont Blanc, something that we alas, will never get to in this class, but a thing that's of very great interest to me is poems that you think rhyme that don't, and poems that you don't think rhyme but do. And that can be an interesting trick. So obviously you can just look at a poem on a page and say, huh, does that rhyme? Well, the first line ends with at, and the second line ends with ing, and the first line ends with over. So it doesn't rhyme. But there are poems that you read and then you remember them, and you remember them as rhyming when they don't. And that is a really neat effect, and something that I was hoping we would get to in the course of the course, but didn't. And then there are poems like Mont Blanc that rhyme, but that you may not notice rhyme. And you may have to have that pointed out to you because of the Vedic powers of rhyme. But that can be very neat when rhymes are there, but you don't notice them, or when rhymes are not there, but you remember them. You remember them as rhyming. There are probably songs that work that way that you can think of. Songs that, to your surprise, when you actually Google the words, they don't rhyme at all, but you think of them as rhyming. So here, this poem by no means does it obviously rhyme, but it does, which itself is a kind of tip of the hat to Hemans, but also she's rhyming, as you say, on a word that Hemans is not rhyming on. So it's not, Hemans doesn't have, the boy stood on the burning deck, it was no fun, it just was dreck. Okay, I'm really sorry I did that. But yeah, loves the boy stood on the burning deck trying to recite. The boy stood on the burning deck, loves the sun, stood stammering locution while the poor ship in flames went down. So what ship is going down? In Hemans, it's a real ship.
everything is falling apart when he's trying to recite this poem. He's like stammering, he's not saying it clearly. So his like performance, in a sense, is the ship falling apart.
Okay, yeah, good. Ilanish?
Maybe the passion or the spark. I was also gonna ask, like, is there a significance of this poet, like, kind of using like a male or like a boy, like when they say boy, son, opposed to just person or like girl or woman?
Okay, yeah, good. Very good question. Anyone have an answer to that?
Like, why you gotta be a boy?
All right, so let's just say you had only the first three words, loves the boy. Who would you be referring to?
The boy from the other poem.
Okay, let's say you didn't know, just all you had, you know, there's an Ezra Pound poem, which is called something like Fragment of an Ancient Text, and it's simply... It's like there's just I think it might be Fragment of Papyrus, but it's just simply a couple of words from an ancient poem, all that survived. And the first line, it's a little bit like, remember the poetess Boot Lime, which some of you did for extra credit? Fire, desire, thigh, lie, night, delight, that one. So this is how long, and then the name of a person. That's all that survives. But it's all you need, right? It's like, I mean, that's Pound's point, is that it's a poem of longing and loss and desire and hopelessness, or hopeful hopelessness, or hopeless hopefulness. So it's just a beautiful thing. It's just three words. You need to know it's part of a longer poem, but you don't need to know any more than that because you know what the longer poem would be saying. So here... Imagine you found a fragment of a poem which simply said, loves the boy. That's all. No Casabianca, no reference to another poem. You wouldn't know from Loves the Boy that this was about the boy stood on the burning deck. It's like not every poem which mentions a boy is about that. Emerson has a poem in which he talks about the deep-eyed boy. And it's actually an elegy for his son who died at the age of 6, and he's remembering him as the deep-eyed boy. Yeah, it's an amazingly moving poem. But so, Loves the Boy, you find that as a fragment. What's it about? Just picture it, Loves the Boy. What are you picturing?
A boy? Someone loves him? Like, maybe it's a parent talking about how much they love their child or something. Like,
parents don't say, oh, look, loves the boy.
Well, like, I don't know.
Attaboy, love!
Is this sexist?
Is it sexist? She is writing about her relationship with her lover who, it may be sexist, but they're both women. So... I wouldn't worry too much about the gender as indicative of sexual preference.
Is that like a literary move? Like, you said her spell.
A trope, you mean?
That?
Yeah. Not her spouse, but the woman she lived with and had a terrible breakup with, as in even losing you, a face, a gesture. So, I think you probably have this picture in your mind, but you're just resisting it. Loves the boy. When is love ever a boy? What does that mean? What is that trope? In what text would love be described as a boy? What Vedic powers can flow into you to answer this question? This would belong to a pre-modernism era. Love as a boy. How would you draw a picture of love as a boy? Cupid. Yes!
Oh.
Oh! Oh.
Yes, Eros, which is the unfun version of Cupid. I mean, unfun as in unmischievous. So Cupid or Eros, son of
Aphrodite
or in Roman
Venus.
Or Venus. Yeah. So Venus is the goddess of
love.
Love, and her son Eros. There's actually an English word that comes from Eros. It's four letters long. It begins with an E and ends with an S.
Eros?
No, Eros.
Sure.
As in erotic, Eros. If you feel Eros for someone, you have an erotic feeling towards them. Where erotic doesn't mean, oh, how sexy. Erotic means I am in love with that person. So Eros, love is Eros, or Eros is the boy stood on the burning deck. So love stands on the burning deck. Someone is moved to say this, to work on writing this poem, that the ship is going down, but love is staying faithful, like the boy on the burning deck. Who's breaking up with whom? This is a leading question, but I think the answer is not that hard.
Is breaking up with her?
The other woman is breaking up with her. Yes. And she is saying, my love for you is standing on the burning deck. That's how it begins. Even as the ship is going down, I keep trying to recite a poem or my love or Eros. Personification is trying to recite a poem about faithfulness, even in disaster. Loves the boy stood on the burning deck, trying to recite the boy stood on the burning deck. What is she trying to do in this poem called Casabianca?
A call back to the original poem?
Yeah, okay. And interestingly enough, a Latinate word for callback would be recite. So it's as though in writing the poem, she is trying to do what the boy did in Casabianca. The ship is going down, but I'm still trying to express my love for you, my faithfulness for you, my desperation for you to answer me, even as the ship goes down. As the boy in the original poem keeps calling to his father, she is calling to her lover. Okay, we'll pick it up here. We're not done with this poem. We will pick it up here. But read through all of these again, lest, God forbid, there should be a quiz on Thursday. A surprise quiz on this, on this sheet of poetry that you got today. A complete surprise to you if there is such a quiz, but these things can happen.
Like
they sometimes do.
Or just the ones we went over?
No, it's one sheet of poems, one two-sided sheet of poems. This class has so fucking little reading in it. I mean, seriously. Read these poems. Spend your 9 hours of home time for this week reading these poems. And if you do that, it'll be great.